Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host Reed Robison and I are joined by Third Wave CEO and founder Paul Austin. It's always great to talk to Paul. This is actually the second time we've had Paul on the show, and if you haven't been to Third Wave's website yet, go check it out. It's bursting with education and resources on how to use psychedelic tools intentionally, responsibly, and effectively. In today's conversation, we discuss Paul's personal and entrepreneurial journey with psychedelics, particularly with microdosing, Third Wave's coaching certificate program, using psychedelic tools for creativity and flow, the importance of shadow work, the balance between ego disillusion and ego inflation, entrepreneurship, psychedelic retreats, leadership, community, group work, what Paul's experiences as a result of his public boldness and transparency in the psychedelic space have been like, and much, much more. A couple of announcements before we get into the episode. If you're looking for professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic assisted practitioner, you can check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. Click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/training. You can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. You hear Reed and I talk a lot about the psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does. If you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. If you'd like to support our show, you can do so by leaving us a review or a rating in places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you're watching on YouTube, please like the video. You can comment below about what you thought. Maybe send the video to somebody you think might like to hear the interview. Without further delay, I bring you Paul Austin. Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. We have a rare treat here. So this is, I think, the first time we've had somebody on external to Numinous for the second time. We got Paul Austin from Third Wave. Welcome back, Paul.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me on. It's good to be back on the show.
So we thought it'd be fun just to sort of catch up. We were talking before we hit record. 2 years is quite a while. If you haven't listened to our first interview, I think we did that back in July of 22. So Correct. Listeners go check that out. But maybe give a brief intro about who you are and what Third Wave is for the folks who don't know you. And then, give us an update.
Yeah. So I'd say my story starts in Michigan. I grew up in like a small town, a suburb of a small city in West Michigan, in a more traditional, I would say, sheltered family environment, very middle class. My dad was like an educator. My mom was a social worker. And we went to church every Sunday. Church was like the backbone of our life. It wasn't fundamentalist and it wasn't radical or anything, but it was like, I was at church 4 hours a Sunday every Sunday, and you know, I went on mission trips all over. So it was definitely a devotional path. And when I was 16, I started smoking cannabis, and my parents found out. And as you can imagine, the sort of golden boy perch that they had put me on fell off pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And so this whole sort of conversation ensued, and from that moment, I just continue to be an explorer and in many ways. And so at the age of 19, I tried LSD for the first time, incredibly influential and such a powerful experience of deep connection to the earth and the friends that I was with. And that inspired me to go and live as a digital nomad. So when I was 21, I moved to Turkey. I taught English in Turkey for a year. And then I would teach I had a really good job. I was tutoring the son of the owner. It was a private school. So the son of the owner, he was getting ready to go to Harvard and Yale, you know, apply for major schools. And so I trained him 16 hours a week in this TOEFL test. And then I had a couple other classes that I taught to all the really high level bright students. So it was very good. And I had a ton of spare time. I only worked like 20 hours a week and I did everything on the fly. I like prepared a tiny bit, but I didn't do much preparation. So I'd have 20 hours a week to dedicate to watching TED Talks and reading books and testing out. I tested out my first online blog called Travel and Wellness. If you search for it, it'll still show up. It was like 12 years ago. It was about staying healthy while traveling. I got linked to Mark's Daily Apple. So Mark Sisson, who's pretty big in the paleo primal movement, you know, sold his company for 9 figures to Kraft. I had an article, you know, reposted from his weekly breakdown and was like, oh, I see sort of the power of this and what it can do. And then it didn't go much, but I started a new project called TOEFL Speaking Teacher, where I grew that to like a solid six-figure level, and it paid for my travels to Thailand. I lived in Portugal. I lived in Budapest. I lived in Mexico. I lived in New York. And then I sold that in 2017 because a couple of years back while I was living in Budapest, I was on acid again at a high dose just before I started microdosing with a couple of friends. And we came up with this idea of the third wave of psychedelics, both as entrepreneurs, but also as people interested in social impact. How could the sort of reevaluation of psychedelic substances rooted in scientific literacy, but also indigenous tradition, how could that help to inform this third wave of psychedelics where microdosing is more prominent? It's the cultural bridge to widespread accessibility, and that we essentially build for a more decentralized ecosystem, which at a very fundamental level means that, you know, in the psychedelic realm, more journeys and more experiences will be had in local communities, you know, in people's houses, in churches, then potentially in clinical institutions or through clinical regulations. So that's really been, you know, I've had a few other projects in that span of time, but that's like the overall professional and career trajectory. And, you know, that all sort of, just to bring this back to the crux of the story, in 2018, when Michael Pollan published his book, How to Change Your Mind, I sent that to my dad and he read it because, you know, at that point in time, my parents, as soon as I started Third Wave in 2015, my parents knew, and, you know, that I was publicly involved in psychedelics. I never hid it from them in any way. And so their support eventually grew to the point where my dad ended up microdosing, and then I led him through a high dose psilocybin journey, you know? And so I saw just in my own family and close to home, how just approaching this in a very level-headed, you know, accessible way, it could be a great entry point for more people to have at least meaningful and healing experiences through psychedelics. I think there will always be a small sub niche that have these profound mystical awakenings, but people don't need to have profound mystical awakenings to still experience tangible physiological benefits from working with these substances. And I think microdosing or low doses of psychedelics are a great way to facilitate that outside of clinical regulated more institutions.
You've had a bit of an untraditional path, it sounds like. That's fascinating. And you were a co-founder of a retreat center out in the Netherlands, is that correct? I'm wondering how that came to be. Were you living out there? Have I just always been curious? Because it was a significant one.
Synthesis ended up becoming the gold standard for legal psilocybin retreats for about 18 months, and then COVID hit, and that really derailed it. But since then, there's been a fantastic practitioner training program that they've rolled out. And I mean, the nut of it is I gave a talk about microdosing at a conference called the Next Web, which is like the big tech conference in Europe. And I talked about microdosing. That talk now has over 500,000 views on YouTube. Folks can check it out. I talked about it as a tool for leadership development and workflow optimization. And I did that in Amsterdam, and I invited a Dutch guy, Martijn, who had started a he was a former professional poker player and had co-founded a platform called High Existence. And he wrote about microdosing many years prior to that. So he was really like an early pioneer in that space. And we attended a few conferences together. I invited him. I was speaking at this Next Web. I spoke at a South by Southwest conference that they did with Mercedes-Benz in 2017 in Frankfurt. Buzz Aldrin kind of headlined the festival. And then I talked with like 40 people from Daimler, from Mercedes, who were interested in microdosing, as well as a bunch of other interesting folks. And then, you know, a few months after that, I gave a talk at a one-day self-optimization conference in Zurich, Switzerland, through a think tank called the Gottlieb Duttweiler Institute, which is a think tank of Migros. And Migros is a $1 billion supermarket chain. So the Migros family started this think tank to be on the cutting edge of what was happening. Steven Kotler keynoted that with a talk on flow. And then I followed him and spoke about psychedelics. And we met an investor there, this Swiss English guy who lived in Switzerland. His name is Eric Grotfeld. And he was like an early technology entrepreneur, sharp, super, super sharp guy. And he was our lead investor. Martijn really hit it off with him. He was our lead investor. And then there were two other investors that came in from New York City because I was living in New York City at the time. So I was just going back and forth to Amsterdam, but I was rooting out of New York City, building a really great network base there. And then I focused with Synthesis. you know, I focus a lot more on the marketing and branding. So I did a lot of the front end, a lot of the initial copywriting. We did a lot of the initial promotion through Third Wave to get, this was April 2018 that we had our first three retreats. We had 25 people come. I invited a couple of close friends of mine. And then Michael Pollan's book came out about a month after that. And Third Wave had already been around for a few years at that point in time. So we had pretty good domain authority and started to, we had really good link juice from an SEO perspective. So we just pushed all that to synthesis. Michael Pollan's book comes out. People start, you know, typing into Google, where do I find a legal psilocybin experience, right? Like, where can I actually go do this? And we were at the top. So we just had all these leads that came through. We built it very organically. And I was involved for the first eight retreats and facilitated at all of them. And I also participated in one of the ceremonies. And I took, I probably took 7 grams of mushrooms. It was the most I'd ever taken. And I had this huge emotional release. And I was like, the product's good as well. You know, like the facilitators we had brought in were fantastic. And then it just continued to grow through 2019. They had a transition in 2020. They overraised and over-diluted. And when the economy went not so great, investment dried up, they were just left hanging. And they really had no way to sell the asset. And thankfully, Retreat Guru picked it up. They were going to go bankrupt, but Retreat Guru was the payment processor for all their practitioner training programs. So if Retreat Guru had gone bankrupt, or if Synthesis had gone bankrupt, Retreat Guru would have gone bankrupt. And Retreat Guru is a fantastic resource, has all of these retreats. It's their booking platform. It would decimate the entire retreat psychedelic ecosystem. So Retreat Guru bought it or acquired it. They raised some money to keep it going. And now Retreat Guru is running the practitioner training program in tandem with the Synthesis Institute. So it's not dead. The brand is still alive. I think the ethos is still there. My hope for it is that it continues to become more and more successful and impact more people. And I learned a lot of lessons in that then I applied to starting our own training program through the Psychedelic Coaching Institute. And so when we had our last conversation, that was just kicking off. I was just in our second cohort, and we're now in our sixth cohort, and we have about 35 to 40 students who enroll as that. We do a six, it will be soon become an 8-day intensive in Costa Rica, and it's a 9-month training program. And that's been fun. And so for me, I'm really good at the 0 to 1. I know how to, I've taken 3 companies in the psychedelic space to 7 figures, which is reasonable for such an early period of time. But we've hit a plateau from a business, just speaking kind of on a personal level, we've hit a plateau. And so I've had to think more about how to restructure this so I can continue to launch new projects to get them up quickly, but then have teams come in place and really run them at a higher level. I can be a CEO, but my cap is like, I'm soon approaching it, you know?
So yeah, you mentioned the training program, and that's something I'm really curious about. Because I'm the lead instructor for Numinous's psychotherapy training program, the sort of fundamentals class that we run, this whole certification pathway to train clinicians on how to do psychedelic assisted therapy. But you know, your training program is for coaches in specifically, right?
Specifically, we're shifting some of that to be also inclusive of practitioners, because a lot of people who come in, they're body workers, they're making a career transition from having been successful in the corporate space. Entrepreneurs who are making a transition into executive coaching, who have, you know, sold companies for 8 figures or 9 figures. So it's quite diverse. And so the way the evolution of it is interesting. And, you know, my intention has always been to be a bridge between the clinical and the leadership performance. So the majority of our faculty are clinically trained. We have 2 MDs, we have a doctor of Chinese medicine, we have a clinical psychologist whose first coaching client happened to be Alexis Ohanian from Reddit, and you know, coach Justin Kahn from Twitch. So his coach to the $1 billion level. And then a transpersonal psychologist. So I've really done my best to go, and then also indigenous medicine women, you know, that we've worked with one woman in particular, Jennifer Andrewley, who is a faculty at the University of Alaska and also has been doing medicine work for 30 years and is an incredible space holder. So we've been very fortunate in that through our relationship with Brave Earth, which is a center for applied cultural transition that's close to La Fortuna in Costa Rica. We've done our intensive work there and developed a very collaborative relationship. And one of the co-founders of that center is a guy named Elnor, And Elnora has been very big in the nonprofit world. He was on the board of Greenpeace for many years, and he started something called Culture Hack, which has been a very influential nonprofit in New York, wrote a book about post-capitalist philanthropy, and is just, you know, a really brilliant mystic and overall incredible human. And so in that relationship, there's just been a lot of great mentorship and guidance. And that's what we emphasized even in our program is, and Steve, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this, and you'll come on my podcast soon so we can go into deeper on this, but it's like the information and knowledge is beneficial, right? The having being able to study the map is useful, right? No doubt about it, right? That's super useful. But depending on the modality, the map may be more useful or less useful, we could say. And the actual navigation of the territory, depending on the modality, could actually be more important. And so where I lean maybe on the more extreme end of this, I'm like 20-80, 80-20. I think the 80% is the map. I'm sorry, 80% is navigating the territory. It's going through the lived experience. It's, you know, starting our own journey and path and learning how to become more equanimous and skillful and, you know, compassionate. But that we quickly need to look at how do we explore and open up other paths that allow for a real integration of this knowledge and wisdom. So living in the jungle, right? Like I've considered what would the role of a dieta look like for certain practitioner training programs to go spend a month in the jungle in dieta, right? That could be like a level 3 or level 4. But for now, the focus has really been on psilocybin. It's really, we focus on what I call the 5 key elements: assessment, preparation, the experience. So this is high doses as well. It's not just microdosing. So how do you assess people coming in? How do you prepare them? How do you help them navigate an experience? And we don't train on guiding necessarily, although a lot of people who go through our training program become guides, but we focus more on then integration and microdosing. So it's sort of dispersed throughout those 5. And the framework or the model that I think I bring, which is more unique, is I'm a former athlete. I also played the violin for many years. I think there's something to be said for practice and skill development that hasn't been talked about or covered much in the broader psychedelic ecosystem, that we would benefit from looking at our relationship with psychedelics as a skill that we develop and cultivate. And so depending on the context, we have a different preference for the medicine that we work with, whether it's 10 micrograms of LSD, whether it's a half gram of mushrooms, whether it's, you know, 100 milligrams of MDMA or, you know, iboga, you know, root, what do they call it? It's the flood dose of the iboga, whatever the sort of context and situation asks for, you know how to navigate. Not only that for yourself, that's an important first stepping point, but this is more for others. This is to be in service of others. This is to support others from a truly, I think, health and well-being perspective. So we get deep into physiology. I talk a lot about the role of lifestyle, diet, exercise, sleep. I'd say that's what we really know best. And then we talk some about trauma. We have a few faculty who are focused on that as part of what they're bringing to the course. But the overall emphasis is more on leadership, performance, and well-being. Right? I'm interested in kind of supporting this emerging ecosystem of entrepreneurs, creators, builders, people who want to become more independent and sovereign. That's who I'd like to continue to build for within this space. So that's making a transition now this year. I was booked to speak at an EO conference. EO Entrepreneurs Organization is they're a global conference. I think you need a minimum of $1 million in annual revenue to be part of it. I'm giving a talk for their EO Canada group in Prince Edward Island, which should be beautiful. And I've done some talks at conferences, but not much since that 2018 period. And so that'll be cool just to see where the woman that I spoke to, even who's part of their organization, was like, I've never tried psychedelics, but I'm curious about them. And I'd be interested to learn more. And I think that's where a lot of people will be coming at it from. So that for me is where I'm really keen and excited to focus on next. That's probably the next project you'll see come out of this kind of psychedelic archipelago of brands, which will be enterprise level. I want to do something enterprise. I want to, like, how cool would it be to go into Apple and do enterprise level training for their developers and artists and programmers and engineers and decision makers with like low doses of mushrooms? That'd be so cool. You know, and so effective and so helpful.
I have a suspicion like a that there are a lot of people at Apple already using those medicines.
Exactly. So create a more regulated structure for it. Let it just be transparent. Make sure it's well communicated. Collect research and data. Track outcomes. Look at performance. Right? Like really be a model for these new aspects of business. And I think that's where, you know, on a personal level, I've always been very enthusiastic about is what is this bridge between leadership and systems theory. So how do leaders who are informed or influenced by psychedelic work, how does their perspective of systems, or how do they develop their understood perspective of systems theory, and how might that be applied to business and politics and education and healthcare and these various domains that we live within?
What would you say to the critics? And I'm sure you've had your fair share of criticism, right? But I'm thinking especially
a little bit.
critics of the places where psychedelics overlap with capitalism, right? With enterprise, with business. I'll leave it broad, but like as I said, I imagine you've gotten a little bit here and there. How do you respond to that type of probably, you know, a lot of it's important criticism, maybe some of it a bit over the top, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think there will always be, what I love about the United States and America is it really is a hub for incredible entrepreneurial ventures, and that here more than anywhere else, there's more and more of an opportunity for individual practitioners to develop a business that supports their way of being and their lifestyle. And I think what I'm driven by most is how do we build a small business ecosystem supporting in like ethical, well-trained practitioners who are not just necessarily Instagram shamans. It's not determined by, you know, their follower count, but there could be an element of that. That might be how we create some awareness, but really about the integrity of their work and supporting them as they look to build and grow their own businesses. I think that's what I'm most enthusiastic about and most inspired by. My own personal relationship to money is I've always had enough, and what I've needed has come through, and I've always looked for ways to recirculate it and continuing to grow, you know, the companies that I've been building. And even, you know, what I'm most, I would say, inspired by, the model that I'm most inspired by, which I haven't really talked about publicly much, is the Vipassana model, right? Where are you too familiar with Vipassana, Goenka, the model that he's built with meditation? Yeah. Have you been on one, Reed?
No, I have not, especially Steven, not one have of you those been on one? Extended ones. Yeah.
Well, Reed's a yogi though, or a yoga practitioner and yoga teacher. He's got more experience with the Vipassana meditation than I do, but.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, it's interesting, right? I'll tell a brief story and I'll loop back all of this around, because I really think it speaks to my personal ethos and what I hope is best in stewardship for the broader psychedelic ecosystem. Goenka, was a very wealthy businessman in Burma in the 50s and 60s. And he developed a morphine addiction, and he went all over the world to get treatment. Nothing worked. He came back home, and one of his neighbors happened to be a really well-known monk and also work for the Burmese government. And he's like, just come do this 10-day Vipassana, right? And it cured Goenka of his morphine addiction. And he started going around teaching and holding these Vipassanas. And this, of course, aligned with the second wave of psychedelics, the counterculture, right? This much more openness. So he had a lot of Americans coming there, but also in India. And he brought his business acumen and expertise to this way of meditation. And there are now over, I think, 165 centers or 150 centers around the world. 100,000 students go through it every year. It's by donation only. It's on a volunteer basis only. So only volunteers, only donations. And you have, you know, humble quarters, but I had my own cell. It was quite nice. The small bed, simple bathroom. And I spent 10 hours a day in meditation. You get up at 4, you start meditating at 4:30 till 6:30. You have breakfast. You start meditating again at 8 to 11. You have lunch, and then the rest of the afternoon. And every evening, there's a discourse of 1 hour. That you get from Goenka. And it's just transformative. I've done a lot of psychedelic work I've been meditating for 15 years, but I'd never gone to that depth and that sense of just total and incredible peace and equanimity. And I was in Joshua Tree for it. It was like the most magical setting. I would go for walks outdoors in the desert, high desert, and I would just see these incredible sunsets and incredible sunrises. It was beautiful. And so that would be my sort of hope and dream for the psychedelic space, is we can develop a model that is by donation only and by volunteer basis only. Mm-hmm. And that it ideally uses psilocybin as a sacrament because that's very inexpensive to grow. Everyone could just have a center in there. It's non-dogmatic. It's secular in nature. But there are, like, when you go to a Goenka retreat, there's like printed instructions. It's like, these are your do's and these are your don'ts. And you just set up a similar container for psilocybin screen. They do a pretty deep screening process. Not everyone is let into a Vipassana. You have to, I mentioned how I had a, you know, undiagnosed, untreated history of, you know, some depression and anxiety. And, you know, the monk or the facilitator set up a conversation with me and we talked through it. And I told him I was microdosing and he's like, but you can't microdose during the Vipassana. I was like, I understand that. I don't need to microdose during the Vipassana. And it was cool to get that level of care. And even during the 10-day Vipassana, he called me in at once. He's like, because you can go have 5-minute check-ins with these lead facilitators. He called me in and was like, you just want to check you're doing okay. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm great. Like this is nothing new. It felt really good. I had actually 6 months prior or 5 months prior to that done my first dieta. So I did a 10-day dieta in the Costa Rican jungle with three Shipibo women. And I dieted something called Guayusa. And so I talked to a good friend of mine and I'm like, 10-day dieta versus 10-day Vipassana. And he's like, if you want to go even deeper, go do the Vipassana. Because in the dieta, you can still read, you can still write, you can still play music, you can still, you know, like engage the brain. Vipassana, nothing. You cannot write, you cannot read, you cannot, no forms of entertainment. You're literally, if you're not sitting in meditation, you're sleeping or you're going for walks, basically, or just sitting there doing nothing.
There's one in Idaho, I believe, one of his centers, Lava Hot Springs, perhaps near Utah.
Yeah, there's probably 20 to 25 in the United States, maybe. 15 to 20, actually, something like that.
I'm curious about your dieta as well and Guayusa, because my understanding is that's a, well, among other things, caffeinated. I'm wondering, were you heavily caffeinated communing with that plant the whole 10 days?
Well, the dieta, so we had four options. We could do Bobinsana, we could do Marusa, we could work with Guayusa, and there was a fourth, I think it was a tree that people could diet. Most people chose Marusa. Some people chose Bobinsana. I was one of the few who chose Guayusa. It just resonated the plant. It's like, you know, you can do a dieta without ayahuasca, right? You can just go have and work with these master plants is what they call them. But the ayahuasca is an additional detoxifier and purgative. And it really just accelerates the whole cleaning of the entire system, the gut, the brain, the body. There's just a lot of cleansing that happens within that. Which is why it's so important that leading up to that, there's, you know, no meat, no pork, you know, not a lot of heavy foods the week before, no cannabis a month before. You're really creating a container for sensitivity. And then the ayahuasca just goes, like, supercharges it. So you can really start to, like, I would have dreams with this plant. I had a couple dreams and it would come into even my post-ayahuasca visions. You know, I would go out and lay in a hammock by the pond at like 4 a.m. because I just drank 2 cups of ayahuasca and I wasn't tired. So I would lay in this hammock 4 a.m. and just sort of tap into this very non-dual state and have this interesting conversation and relationship with this plant that was quite happy. It's quite, I wouldn't describe it as euphoric necessarily, but very freeing, a lot of energy. You know, I'm a very high energy person. I go, go, go. And so to have that felt very replenishing and nourishing. So cool. Overall, like an incredibly beneficial experience. I would love to go longer. And for me, the perfect set and setting, I didn't go into Peru necessarily in the deep jungle. I was at the same center where we host our intensives for our own practitioner training program. I did the dieta there and it's quite nice.
Yeah, I love that concept of kind of building a relationship with a plant. I've always just been fascinated and have experienced it in small ways, including a little with Bobinsana, but I just, it's something that seems so lacking here in our culture is that connection with the plants. And, you know, I worked with shamans who would say like, oh, I can't work on this certain condition, this kind of person in this situation because I haven't done a dieta with this plant yet, or they're building these relationships to add more and more tools to their toolkit or to expand their capabilities as a shaman and some of these lineages too. It's really cool.
It is very cool. Yeah. And it's a whole new way of understanding and interacting. David Abram is a pretty well-known ecological writer. He wrote a book called Spell of the Sensuous, which was how, you know, especially in the last 300 years, during 400 years, during industrialism, we've become very monodimensional in how we can attune to the world around us. It's very linear. It's very much through words. And we've lost touch with this whole dimension of self, which is this, primordial self that's much more in touch with the seasons and the weather and the nature and the trees. That side of us has been, just not really... especially the last 100-150 years, not really nourished. So plant medicines, I think, help with that. There's this sort of people experience this primordial, wild, pre-verbal state oftentimes in psychedelics, which can be helpful for healing the shadow and healing, unexpressed parts of self that have become repressed or shut down or, quieted, which I think that is all welcome. And then of course, how do we handle that? How do we navigate that? Well, that's gotta be in community, right? And I would even say really into nature, lean more into nature, lean more into her lessons and what she's teaching, and have that as the new barometer rather than, humans who you're playing these social status ego games with for the most part.
Yeah, totally. It reminds me of, I think it's from Braiding Sweetgrass, another great book recommendation. Yeah. But in there it says that in some Native American languages, the translation for plant is those who take care of us.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that, Reed.
Yeah, nature and community, Paul. That's I feel like you hit a couple nails on the head with that. And I'm curious to know, I was having this conversation with one of my kids the other day, like feeling disembodied, feeling low, feeling down, and asked him, well, when's the last time you were outside for longer than 5 minutes without your phone in your hand? And when's the last time you actually like hung out with your friends without staring at your phone or something like that? So I'm curious, and I know that third wave is involved to some extent in endeavors to this extent, but what's the role that connection with nature and doing this work in community do you think plays in the psychedelic ecosystem?
Well, I think it's the oldest lineage that we have. It's the oldest and most practiced tradition. I think it's where the majority of benefits come from, back to this sort of 80-20, right? The theory and the map is interesting. It's useful as an initial compass point, but that most of the work is to be done walking the territory and navigating it. And there's no better way to do that than by, starting down that path with psychedelics. And what we've learned from the 60s, I was telling you both of you about this book I'm reading right now called From Counterculture to Cyberculture, Stuart Brand, The Whole Earth Network and the Rise of Digital Utopianism. And it talks a lot about how the early use of LSD in the 1960s influenced this whole new communalist movement. So the new communalist movement. And at one point, there were 600 to 700 communes in the United States in the late 60s to early 70s to mid 70s. And Stuart Brand created something called the Whole Earth Catalog, which was like Steve Jobs described it as Google before Google, where they would create a catalog of everything that these people living on communes would need, from the most high tech to the most fundamental and basic picks and shovels and everything else. And really were, this was like the birthing of Silicon Valley culture. Right. And so now it's interesting to see how we're coming full circle, where you have a lot of, this center that I just described in Brave Earth that I've been talking about is a center for applied cultural transition. They're building out on half of their 88 acres. They have a retreat center. That's the economic engine. And on the other half, they're building residential, and they have 27 stewards. They'll have up to 80 people living there. And there's more and more individuals and people who are doing this. And modern technology enables this because remote work is very easy. We don't have to be constrained to a geographical location in order to generate income and revenue for ourselves. And so the technology that now supports the successful development of this sort of new, this communalist movement, we need to have a new name for it. It's this communalist movement that's occurring. But instead of it, like, it was very intense and extreme in the 60s. This is true with acid. This is also true with the new communalist movement. 600 to 700 communes in the span of 5 to 6 years, most of them didn't last more than 5 years, right? We're seeing this somewhat in the psychedelic ecosystem. You know, we're not there yet. 2025 will be the 5 year mark, but we'll see. We'll go, how many companies are there now? 600, 700? We'll go from that to probably 100. You know, there will be sort of a calling off there as well in the next couple of years. So the role then that community, I think, in nature plays is it is our oldest ally. It's what we know best. I think the more that we can create these centers and places for people to live in and exist in, it will be beneficial for everyone. And that ideally we come into some sort of like, I like the notion of like a city state model where governance is much more local. And there's essentially, it's more of a tribal, but not tribal in the evolved sense. If you're looking at spiral dynamics, tribal in the teal sense, not in the red sense necessarily. So, and I think we have an opportunity to ideally, and they thought this in the 60s, we thought this for a long time, but we're approaching a number of precipices where we may be able to, I don't know, evolve outside of having hot war, the way there may still be cold wars, but hot war maybe become a thing of the past. I don't know. That's maybe very idealistic of me, but that's what I would hope for.
We need some idealism. Yeah. I mean, what you said, it sparked kind of a complicated thought. So I'll try to articulate it, but you know, tribal in the teal sense and not the red sense. When I think of communities and communes, I also think of kind of our early conversation about psychedelics for those who are highly ambitious and motivated, and how sometimes a psychedelic experience isn't ego dissolving, it's ego inflating. And you get organizations that are cohesive that can also be cult-like, led by charismatic leaders, right? And I remember Jamie Wheel say something like, oxytocin is the hug your neighbor neurochemical. It's also the curb stomp your enemy neurochemical. It's what creates in-groups and out-groups. So I think it's a delicate balance, a double-edged sword, pick your idiom or your metaphor. But, I think there is as much promise, there is as much peril with psychedelics creating in-group, out-group perspectives. But I wonder if this is something you think about at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good question, right? I think there's a need to have a healthy ego. There's a need to have a healthy sense of self. This is what the Greeks have taught us. This is what has carried Western civilization, the individual self, the recognition, you know, private property. There's some very structural things that have been beneficial in that way that I think we still need to honor and recognize and do our own work to come to a healthy egoic sense of self. It's important to have that. And equally, what psychedelics can teach is this much more expanded sense of self, this transpersonal self, right? This self that is non-dual, this self that is outside of description and time and linearity. And we want both. And the individuals and people in leadership positions, you know, I think if done within supportive containers, if done at an early enough age as well, age makes a difference, right? It's why they were used in rites of passage with men who were 12, 13, 14, 15, not 60. Right. But we're making up for lost time, okay? It's going to be a generational thing, but I think we can get to a much more healthy development of especially the male egoic self with the aid of psychedelics and plant medicine. That would be my sort of hope. I do agree with you that there's risks. I do agree with you that with any emerging technology, which I would consider psychedelics to be an emerging technology, as much as they are ancient, they're also very emergent. So whenever we are work with these, there's a high degree of uncertainty and unknown. And I think psychedelics can help us to be discerning and make good decisions as long as it's within a community that's healthy And I think this is then the key is, and for anyone who's a community leader to even ask that, like, do you have a healthy sense of your shadow? Do you have a healthy sense of your own psychological stability? Do you have a healthy sense of, sexual boundaries in particular? That it's a complicated and fiery and edgy way to live.
Yeah, well said. Yeah, I think, in as much as a psychedelic experience helps you see yourself and find yourself as much as it helps you lose yourself to that end, I think it can be helpful. But I'm sure you've seen it. I've just seen it time and time
again. But shadow gets amplified, Steve. Yeah, and I guess that's my point. Like, shadow gets amplified. If you haven't learned, especially as a man, how to eat your own shadow, how to do deep shadow work, how to kind of have this sort of total loss of egoic self and confrontation with the deep divine, that I think is a necessary and essential aspect, because a sliver of a shadow when spread over a community will be, it's like the eclipse today, to some degree. So, we become magnified when we step into leadership positions, and there's a lot of good tool. I mean, that's why cyberculture, early counterculture, early cyberculture, even what's developing now is so interesting, because there's fewer whales. There's less constriction of energetic resources. And you have someone like Elon Musk, who, he's the second wealthiest man in the world, but he's also gone on record saying, and I think there's a lot of integrity in what he says, that money doesn't motivate him. This sort of leaving a very positive and impactful footprint on the earth, right? He comes from very, I think, surprisingly pure intentions, and it's motivating and inspiring to see. Now, again, maybe I'm just naive.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what I don't know. I think the intentions really matter, right? Like you said, because, if you feel called to leadership, I think it's important that you take a close look with a microscope on the motivations for that call. Is it a call to leadership because it's really important for you and your ego to make an impact, even if you are telling yourself the story that it's a positive impact? Or do you feel a call to service? To elevate the community, elevate the collective, spare people from suffering. And it's okay if your ego like takes a few candies from that jar and feels good about what you do, I think. But when that's sort of, like you said, the sliver of the shadow that's spread across the entire work, I think that's when you see people do damage at scale.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting that Elon Musk is subject to all these drug tests because he has opened up about
the ketamine abuse? Watch out, ketamine.
Smoking pot on Joe Rogan's podcast.
Yeah. No, God, the horror.
How dare
he? The horror.
Yeah, it is interesting. It just reminds me of all of these great Carl Jung nuggets of wisdom that, we like to quote a lot of that on here that, like if you don't make the unconscious conscious, but another way he puts it is everyone has a shadow, and the less you embody it in your life, the blacker and denser and more scary it gets, right?
Exactly.
And it's okay. Like, I like that you pointed out that we need an ego. Like, I had a meditation teacher once upon a time say something that just stuck with me. You need enough ego so you don't get hit by a bus, a bare minimum, right? You've got to be able to navigate life as an individual separate self, and you want it to not be too out of control. And there are a lot of implications for the psychedelic work and a lot of misconceptions too, of people wanting to absolutely obliterate it, or people maybe accidentally strengthening it in ways they don't want to. But yeah, I love that question of what is one's intention, especially in these pursuits or leadership duties. And I like to also recognize that you can have more than one intention of things. Like, you can have an intention to go to yoga class get embodied and attain enlightened states, and to get a good workout, for example. I mean, there are multiple intentions, like someone making a living and someone contributing to world peace. They don't have to be at odds.
Ideally, right? And that's what was coming up for me, is it should be fun and playful as well. That especially if you're choosing it entrepreneurially, even I would say entrepreneurially, get involved in the psychedelic ecosystem, it's got to be fun, because if it gets too heavy, if you're too much in the sort of depths of it, it can eat you alive. And so I also find that the way to be sustaining in this is, and that was always my early experiences with LSD were always very blissful and joyful. I struggled with, you know, like I said, untreated, undiagnosed depression, probably from the age of like 15, 16 till I was 25, 26. And psychedelics helped tremendously. And LSD will and always has been my favorite because I always had a more melancholic side. But that playfulness, that fun, that's what keeps me going 9 years in, you know, third wave. We've been doing it 9 years now, three companies. It's just like, I could play in this way forever. And that is, as long as it continues to stay fun and energizing and impactful, I think that's also on a personal level what to consider for ourselves as we do this. If we have to balance gravity with levity.
Yeah, yeah. And Carl Jung will also point out that it's like to confront one's shadow is, you know, it's no small task, right? It takes considerable moral effort. And I think that's what people shy away from, admitting the taboo, like admitting that there are what religions might say carnal desires or things like that, or just like admitting the humanity. And I like this kind of concept lately of like avert your gaze to nothing, or nothing is really off limits in the exploration of this, if that makes sense. It's just something I've been sitting with.
I love that.
Yeah, I like what you said about the levity, Paul, and especially about with respect to entrepreneurs, because I have a lot of entrepreneurial clients who, for me, they're coming to me for, you know, psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. They've got deep wounds, and I've made some observations about sort of the if you could call entrepreneurialism a phenotype. Like, a lot of people arrive at it from different places, but I've noticed a lot of entrepreneurs are fueled by what one might call some like dirty fuel, like if we compare coal to solar or something like that. So show me a male entrepreneur who's focused on growth, and I'll show you a man whose dad didn't approve of him or something like that, right? So I'm curious, how have you found your way, or maybe you didn't have to find it, maybe it's sort of innate, to playfulness in entrepreneurship?
Well, I think it goes back to, I played, you know, I loved sports growing up. You know, I love sports. I played soccer. I played baseball. I played through college. You know, I played the violin for 11 years. So I just played a lot naturally. I also played a lot of video games. I was huge into video games, right? So I played a lot of that. So I was just always very entranced by, the sort of concept and idea of play. And, It for me, it's always what was, you know, ideally, obviously the most fun. And then, you know, out of college and getting into focusing on, you know, a family, and I don't have a family, but I'm just saying, like, around this age, right, and a career and a certain level of income, we just naturally get distance. Most of us, many of us, I should say, get distance from that. So, we largely get distanced from it, I think, because we pursue work that is not all that meaningful, right? It's not all that fulfilling at a deep level. And I think I was just very fortunate that from the age of 21, my first job, I found to be very fulfilling and meaningful. And I think it's partly just because of how I was raised. My dad worked, you know, he's still at the same liberal arts school in Michigan. He's been there for 43 years.
Wow.
Right. As an educator, my mom was a social worker for 30 some years in the hospital. So for me, it's always been like, I was fortunate to find my vocation. And that was my dad's role. My dad was like, he's the head of the career services. So he helps people with resumes, CVs, vocation. And I just happened to figure it out young, I think probably because I had that guidance to some degree. So I've always just found, if I'm going to, and through those early LSD experiences, I sort of reconfigured my relationship to money. I reconfigured my relationship to conventionality. I thought it would be much more interesting to spend my 20s traveling and being nomadic. You know, I traveled to 70 some countries. I've lived in 12 major cities. Spent it that way rather than trying to collect things. So I got really into minimalism and all those. And that's another way to, you know, less clutter creates more space for creativity and exploration and freedom, you know? And so I always was like, hey, I even if I'm starting third wave and I was overseas at the time. For the first couple of years I ran Third Wave, I was overseas because I was like, just in case anything happens, you know, I don't know how this experiment's going to go. I'm putting my name on, you know, out in a public eye. I'm talking about LSD. I'm giving consulting calls. You know, I had some really early media in the New York Times and Rolling Stone. And I was like, I don't know where this is, but it was just cool the whole time. You know, I've never had an issue. I've had one minor issue, which is that I got pulled aside by airport security and they searched me in tandem once. This happened 5-6 months ago. And interestingly enough, and I share this publicly for better or worse, I had global entry for many years. And global entry is a way where you can, I traveled so much. I wanted to, when I come back into the States, you can just scan your passport. You don't have to wait in the passport line. I show up at a flight like 5-6 months ago to go to a conference. And they're like, yeah, your pre-check, TSA pre-check number is on here, but it's not working. And I logged in online. My global entry had been revoked.
Whoa.
With no reason given. And so now I'm like, I'm on a list. I must be on a list. They don't just revoke your global entry. I've reapplied. I sort of wrote to them. I haven't heard back. There's been crickets on the other end. So now I can't get pre-check at the airports and can't get global entry coming back in. And I'm like, something's up.
Because of what? What's your theory again? Because they stopped.
Because I'm very public about my psychedelic use.
I see.
We had an article written in Inc. This. We did an Aspen event, you know, legal in Colorado last September. And there's a picture of Inc. and me handing out mushrooms to everyone. Because it's microdoses. It's legal. Josh was there. Josh Kappel, who's my lawyer. Josh can attest to the legality of everything that we were doing by Colorado law. But it's still there. So I wonder if that triggered a search or, you know, kind of put off some alarm bells or maybe they're just like keeping an eye more and more on psychedelic people because it's getting quite big and prominent.
Didn't you also give
And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not a person who's paranoid. I'm not any of that. And yet it's interesting to see. So I'm moving to Portugal. So that's the other major update. I'm selling my car in California and I don't have much, but I'm getting things that I do have and I'm moving to Portugal. And I'm going to sit out this election cycle and series in Europe, just see how it goes here for the next few years.
Wow. That's intriguing and, you know, concerning about being on the list. Didn't you give a talk once at TED or TEDx talk where you said
that was the talk I was talking about earlier, the microdosing at the next web. I was like, I'm on LSD and I'm giving this talk.
I thought that was bold.
A mini dose of LSD. I wanted to kind of awaken their senses, you know, like mine had been. It was a fun talk. It was early. That was 2017. A little risque. And then and that's where some of the critique has been as well, Steve. The critique has been partly, sure, entrepreneur capitalism, you know, tech bro. I've gotten that flavor of critique. But there have been other forms and flavors of critique as well that have been around some of these other things that we've been talking about.
Yeah, well, you're nothing if not bold. Right. And I think we need
to focus on microdosing and like everyone should be able to access this and do this. And LSD is great. It just the thing that went wrong in the 60s, I tell everyone, is it was high doses and not microdoses. Right. We figured it out now. Microdosing of acid. That's all we need.
Yeah, we just speaking of LSD and I agree, it's such an amazing medicine, but
you don't need more than 20, 25. I mean, sure, you can if you have a high dose and you have a guide and a facilitator, but the most people know, don't do more than that.
We did the phase 2 study with MindMed of LSD for generalized anxiety disorder. And it was really neat to see the results that they've shared, at least some of and more to come, but showing that 100 micrograms was really a beautiful dose for improving a lot of people's anxiety in a lasting way. One dose. Steve and I and our colleagues sat with many people through that study, and it was really
okay. I have a question for you then. Was psychotherapeutic support provided or not? Because the way they framed it in the media was that it wasn't, but I've heard other things.
Well, we were told very specifically, do not do psychotherapy, but we were sitting there and there were some license requirements, you know, physician, if not in the room, on site. You know, one of the facilitators needed to be a licensed professional. But we were told not to do psychotherapy. It does become tricky. It's a debate that is an important one. I know you put it on your Twitter recently, which I I was looking at with interest and thought maybe we could even get into, because Steve and I have done a whole episode here talking about the need for the argument for psychedelic support, psychotherapy, yes or no.
Yeah, I can tell you.
And I think, go ahead, Steve.
Well, from my experience, just to answer your question, I mean, the way they designed the study, they even call us dosing session monitors instead of, like, you know, therapists or psychedelic assisted therapists. And, you know, some other companies studying psychedelics with, quote, psychological support have other terms to describe that role. But it's probably a really hard study design problem to control for the variables, the interpersonal and therapeutic variables that are the result of another human being sitting with somebody. Right. And I also get, like, the appeal of trying to minimize the influence that psychotherapy or psychological support have on trying to get a drug through the FDA sort of approval process. Sure. All that being said, I think it kind of begs the question on what is psychotherapy and what is psychological support and what does it mean for a person to, quote unquote, just trip sit or just guide. But certainly with the folks that I sat with, there were some therapeutic moments, I guess I'll put it that way.
Yeah. And the way I would approach this is like a both and mentality, that there can be both, there can be benefits independent of any psychotherapeutic or coaching support. And there can also be tremendous benefits in psychotherapeutic support. And there can be tremendous benefits within a group container or more communal support. Right. And I think we have to equally look at all three to make recommendations and conclusions about what's the best way to roll this out on a more cultural scale. It has to be all three, right? This has to be independent of individuals. Like, I almost think of it as creatine, right? Whether or not you meet with a coach or an individual, right? If you take creatine every day, it's one of the most best tested supplements. It'll help with energy. It'll help with muscle. It'll help with various things that are quite healthy. And that's irrespective of whether you talk to a professional about it. I have creatine gummies
now. Right. Yeah. Well, if I take 100 milligrams of creatine, I'm not going to see God though. Like, and that's the thing with psychedelics is I worry that if that's a message, not the message you're saying, I agree with you, that it's a both and, but if people read something like MindMed's post and they think, oh, nobody needs psychotherapy in conjunction with psychedelics in order for them to be useful. It could be the case that, you know, and this is well documented, that people can have a psychedelic experience by themselves and it can change their lives. It could even be profoundly healing. But there are going to be some people that really need professional, this is my biased opinion, of course, but professional psychotherapeutic guidance or guidance from, you know, an indigenous person with a lineage that's thousands of years old or from a well-trained coach. And so I think, you know, if we can include all of those things in the conversation, then like you said, we can get better at being prescriptive. Like, this is what you're asking for. Well, this is the kind of support that you do or don't need.
Right. And I think the emphasis on the physiological is important, right? That we see there is just a purely physiological benefit of low doses of psychedelics, whether that's on neurogenesis and dendritic sprouting, whether that's specific to inflammation in the brain and in the gut, there is a strictly physiological benefit to taking low doses of psychedelics. That's my belief. And so if that's the case, then we look at, okay, what if it's beyond just something physiological and it's clearly related to something that is, you know, much more mental, and usually it is, right? This, we are mind and body connected. Then depending on the nature of that, right, you'd be paired with a practitioner. And if it's someone who has depression, PTSD, addiction, then that will need to be done within a container of a therapist. But if it's someone who's simply interested in flow, performance, overall well-being, they have no clinical diagnoses, they are not on any psychiatric medications, then connecting them with a coach and a practitioner is perfectly suitable. And so a lot of it is just in that assessment phase then. Right. And how do we develop more awareness around the assessment phase? Because it is, to some degree, there's nuance to it. And I think we would be remiss to not be intentional about including the lens of the context. There are strictly physiological benefits to taking low doses of psychedelics. And that's a great point of study that hasn't been enough research done in put into that, because it's just so expensive. And most of the initial focuses have been on very specific mental diagnoses, but no doubt we will find that it's just as effective at certain physiological things. So, and then the group is important, right? The group comes back to the community element, because we're much different people in groups than we are one-to-one in psychotherapeutic support. And it's much more it's how reality actually is. So learning how to work with psychedelics and navigating, like, there's so much, even with our intensive that we host in Costa Rica for our practitioners, there's so many things that come up around not being loved, not being worthy, being insecure about introversion, needing time alone, not having enough time alone, boundary development, strong communication, loving presence, right? When you're in that group dynamic for a week in the jungle, and then you do temescals and we do high dose ceremonies and we do a microdose, I mean, you're naturally getting to confront and navigate a bunch of different parts that normally wouldn't be online in just a one-to-one psychotherapeutic setting. And that for me is the key for practitioners in this space, that they're able to explore those parts in community and in relationship, because that's how we create really strong networks. And it goes back to what we were talking about before, that trust within a decentralized ecosystem is what blockchain can help to support, and the technology that we have available can help to support. But it's also what's most in integrity with sort of our human biology, I would argue, and where we're most aligned to have a positive impact on ourselves and others.
Glad you're making this point about groups. You know, I studied group from a group therapy perspective for my dissertation. And, the group is another entity in the room, right? You have the other individual entities, and then you have this gestalt, right? This group in the room. And it's often been said that what gets wounded in relationship needs to be healed in relationship. And just speaking from my own experience personally, I've benefited a lot from individual help from therapists and coaches, but it's a different kind of experience, right? To do ayahuasca in a circle, or, you know, to experience altered states with close friends. And it's very unique, and because it's unique, I think it has some unique opportunities for integration, for healing, for transformation, for insight, for growth, and to heal the things that we're struggling with at all the levels of groupness in our society, whether it's your family, your town, your country, you know, your species.
Absolutely. Well put. Well said.
Paul, we're coming up on an hour. Anything else that you want to talk about, or where might you point people if they want to learn more? Of course, Third Wave's website, but...
So we do a webinar every month. It'll be close to 2 or 3 webinars a month pretty soon. So just our newsletter, our email list at thirdwave.thirdwave.co is a great starting point. We also have a private community there. So we built a private community platform. You can download the app Third Wave Community. Just type that in and join us. And we host private events there and live Q&As. And there's some great conversations and discussions on mushroom cultivation, microdosing, therapeutic work, ketamine, a few other topics. So if folks want to kind of get involved and find the others, that's a great platform to do so. And then if anyone has questions or wants to reach out, I'm on Instagram and Twitter at PaulAustin3W. I'm both pretty frequently.
And Paul's a good follow. So yeah, go follow him on socials. I got to say, I've learned a ton from Third Waves, just the posts on specific psychedelic medicines.
Yeah, same.
When people ask, like, where can I learn more about psilocybin? That's one of the few resources I usually point them to. Like, here's some great free, thorough education that's well-researched. So good job, you guys.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, Paul. It's really fun to chat. So thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Reed. Thanks, Steve. And Steve, I mean, it'll be great to have you on the podcast. Reed, we did ours probably about a year ago now, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And so folks, if you want to hear Reed and I go into it, check out that podcast. And our podcast is called The Psychedelic Podcast. So Steve will be on pretty soon. We'll have an episode with him as well.
Looking forward to it.
Can't wait. Thanks, gents.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.